Is it recording? I can't tell if it's recording or not. I love Zoom. Did you get a recording notification?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah,
Well,
I did too.
welcome to the path forward. Today, I've got Tom Longo and his partner Dexter. We're going to talk up. We've got a variety of topics to talk about, and I'll start with teeing up the situation. So the last two shows, we've talked about cyber warfare and we've talked about AI and generative AI and the different types of AI. Today we're going to expand on that. We're going to talk about both financial, the current threat in the financial markets, current threat, based on AI. And I see a number of different things for me, and I'll tee up one scenario that I was playing with just this week, actually. So I use ChatGPT. And I told ChatGPT to go out and scrape a company's colors, background, and color palette for their website, then create a website that mirrors that with some of the same language, and then set up a credential, not just a credential harvesting, but set up a three-paged sticky site that would bring people to do a survey, gather some of their information, and then fire that off to the global address list for this specific company. And literally within 3 minutes, I had three web pages and it was ready to fire off everything. All I had to do was hit submit and it would have set up the page and away you went. So there is some power to AI, and there we're going to see a transformation, not just on the office side, but on the cyber side as well. And we're going to see a number of sophisticated attacks that will come out of that. But I don't think that's the real threat right now. I think the real threat of AI is really the hype around it and the thought process that it's way more sophisticated than it really is. Because I've been working with AI for 2 years now, actually 2.5 years, and I can tell you that a lot of stuff I've seen is vaporware. It's just an algorithm they're calling AI, but it's really not that smart, and it's really not able to learn. And AI requires you to deploy the solution and then teach it how to analyze and how to manipulate the data that you're putting in there and the information you're putting in there. And a lot of systems just, frankly, they don't do that. And I've seen too, and this goes, and I'll take this back all the way back to blockchain. Remember when blockchain was a thing and everybody's like, yeah, we're moving to blockchain and we're going to do all this high-speed encryption, but nobody can explain exactly what it was? Yeah, I could tell you today they still can't explain how it works. I view AI as the same thing, right? It's the latest toy in the market that everybody thinks they need to move to. I think there's some value because I use Copilot every day, I use ChatGPT every day, and I don't use OpenAI, but I use what's the other alternative for that? It'll come to me. Anyway, I use AI every day, work related, but it's more of looking at logistical trends and looking at how things are moving and where what the shipping's doing, et cetera. So there is some benefits to it, but what I'm doing with AI is more based on just analyzing intelligence. So I'll just tee that up there and let you guys just go.
Well, afternoon, Steve. How are you?
I'm good.
And I'm going to actually pass that one off to Dexter because I think he has far more to talk about from that perspective than I do. So why don't you do the
Okay.
thing, man? We'll go from there.
Sure. I concur that AI hype is hype, but it's not completely false. And I think you're right to compare it to blockchain. And there were a ton of people who just wanted everyone to think they knew something about blockchain and like all the marketing types. I mean, I think AI is something that if you use computers every day, you're probably already have dipped your toe in it and you've realized, oh, this will make me more effective at what I do, but at the same time, I'm not sure I trust, the output. If you do code, you're going to have to play with these toys a lot. I think the big, trying to keep within the idea of like, what are we all preparing for as the controlling idea here is, I think, people need to pay attention to AI, but they also have to be aware there's going to be a lot of short-term malinvestment and a big nonsense frontier to get through. Like when you said, Steve, like it's all hype and it's all vaporware, like that's very true. But the cost of AI in practical terms is going to keep going down. It's going to keep getting cheaper. I think we're going to see data center overinvestment in the short to medium term, and we're going to get software improvement along that same timeline, which is going to change the investment value that people have made. Like Oracle's going to be happy to have spent billions of dollars because they're just going to be able to sell it to everyone. But if OpenAI, the company, decides to invest in a data center to the tunes of billions of dollars, and then the compute needs of AI in general actually go down, companies like OpenAI and Anthropic are in trouble if they overinvest in hardware. So there's weirdly a first mover disadvantage and a second to nth mover advantage within AI itself. You know, that's kind of on my investment side. Like, and just to be clear, I would put Google and Microsoft in one category because they both have a very well-established data, and I put Amazon AWS in this category as well. They both have well-established, you know, space in their data center businesses and adding AI to them. I mean, Amazon's taking kind of an all actors approach, but Google and Microsoft are both branding specific solutions. Second category, I would say, is Anthropic, obviously OpenAI, these companies that are sort of open water AI companies. They're writing software and they're renting hardware. And then you have Facebook/Meta, who's, you know, kind of trying to really heavily invest out of the hole that their Llama LLM is in. And I think they're going to do it. And then lastly, I would put Apple, that I think most people have misunderstood Apple's role in AI, and Apple's going to be a consumer of all these products. And I think Apple's waiting to invest because they already have data centers. And if there's some great amount of software, I think Apple thinks what you think is like, this stuff has been hyped beyond belief. And, you know, how is it going to affect jobs? I think we can talk about that in the next beat, but like, that's kind of my take on where we are business and investment level.
Yeah, I agree with that. Cause nobody's figured out how to monetize it yet. Right. And I think the people that are going to be the industry leaders in it are going to be the ones to figure out how to use it to make their operation more effective or use AI to help them lower costs to do the same thing.
Right. We haven't even proven that it can raise revenue in an appreciable amount. And no one's proven that they can profit off it at scale.
No.
And that's the key thing, is when people start screaming about this company not investing enough or not, it's like, what if that company just wants to preserve its existing margins and they're actually smart? And they're like, we're not going to throw $10 billion down the drain when all of this stuff, like, you know, the last person to act is going to be the guy with the least debt in the long run from the whole enterprise.
Absolutely. And that's the CapEx on that. Go ahead.
What I was going to say is, Dexter, while you were saying that, all it reminded me of is our longstanding argument about AdWords, right? How the bang for the buck on AdWords is the same kind of thing. Same kind of thing. Like each iteration of new technology that is supposed to be the latest thing that's going to change the way we do business and everything else, doesn't necessarily bring on the promises. So, you know, all these people were signed up to Google AdWords in order to get targeted advertising, and they got no bang for the buck. And eventually, you know, they found out that people were mostly Googling their own name, and they had to buy their own name back from Google in order to have search engine results in order to get people to come to their website. It made no sense.
And that's to say nothing of the, I'm going to choose my words carefully, but the level of verifiable users, that Facebook was able to deliver through their ad platform. You know, Google and Facebook both got criticized a hell of a lot for, you know, numbers that weren't really verifiable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, programmatic, you know, presentations of your ad versus an actual set of eyeballs looking at your ad are two different things. So,
right.
Yeah. And the other side of that too is you touched on the point, right? The capital expenses just to invest into AI is prohibitive for, it's going to be prohibitive for a lot of different companies, because I could tell you that, especially, and you'll identify with this, why I'm using this example, right? Healthcare companies, right? That they have to be very mindful about where all of their capital expenses and operational expenses go, because it's a margin business these days and it's all about throughput. And putting in AI, you have to have a very specific purpose. Like, you know, I manage security for a huge radiology company. And if you And I get where the executives are going with it, right? We would sit in a room and they'd say, yeah, if I can replace two radiologists that are like $350,000 a year with AI that could do the same work 24/7 and do the reads 24/7, it's worth it to me. However, comma, the error rate and the cost to implement, and then the cost for storage and the cost for data transformation and data movement, because in the cloud, right, you pay for everything, data exfiltration, data infiltration, all of that. And it gets very expensive very quick, especially when you're dealing with images, et cetera. So I think two limitations to the market, not just monetization, is the cost barrier to get into the market and get into AI that's going to help your business. And then figuring out which AI is actually going to be useful.
Right.
Because there's a ton of AI companies selling garbage.
Well, and the other thing is, I mean, that example I happen to know a lot about. Like radiology PACS systems are not going to be exposed to the internet, and a lot of them are going to be stored on premises, right? And so if you have some AI process that you want to query the metadata within your DICOM files, you're not going to just put that on the computer in the on-prem environment. Like and radiology image stores are enormous. They're not being moved in real time. It's not happening. In fact, when you do a radiology center transfer, you're doing it with shipped hardware. They're Amazon's sending a snowball. No one's opening up a network connection, right? And so there's just a huge lack of practicality. And healthcare in general has been pulled kicking and screaming into the just even the concept of an off-premises data center that they own, i.e., a five location hospital group in a metro area with a single unified data center. Like that should have been done in the 80s. I mean, you were lucky to see it in the 90s or the 2000s, right? It got done in the late 20 to 2010s, you know, as the common model. So them putting AI in those data centers, it's not going to happen. I mean, we're seeing a lot of stuff in healthcare that's, again, it's a lot of hype because the people who know the least about how AI algorithms work are starting to believe things that are not true. You know, they don't understand that there's, you know, and this is mostly within the realm of LLMs still. AI cannot produce a prediction of the future. It cannot solve a problem that has not been solved. It can only render a shuffled version of a solution that exists. You're not going to talk to it about, you know, physics problems or unsolved math problems. It's not going to give you anything. Now, I happen to think that there's advances in artificial reasoning coming, but I don't think any of that really matters in the sense of what how much attrition there's going to be in employment that people need to get ready for. And I think it's not too early to start talking about the consequences of AI deployment. It is, however, helpful to understand the state of the art right now and how that will destroy jobs right now. And at the same time, put our ears to the ground about what might be coming, but not believe the wave of BS, you know, and hype that is going to continue. It's going to keep getting bigger and bigger. AI hype is just getting started.
Yeah. And like blockchain and some of the other let's just say technologies that came and went, I think we'll see an expansion, then consolidation, and then a few players that are top in the market. I can tell you that there's AI that's very beneficial right now, and I use it literally every day. I would spend, 4 to 6 hours reviewing contracts. I'm CISO. That's what I do, right? I'm always looking at contracts, make sure there's security language in there, data protection agreements, all that, right? AI can do that in a fraction of that and give me all the same points that I would call out in every contract or DPA or NDA that I'm reading in a matter of minutes. It saved me hours every day doing that. That work. The other place it can help me is it can do questionnaires, right? Because you do these shared assessment questionnaires. Everybody does it now, where you send it across to a vendor and you do a risk assessment based on that. Then you score the vendor and tell me that you're great or you suck. And you give them a risk rating, right? It can do all of that. It can answer all the questions. As long as it's pre-populated and as long as you feed it the right answers to the question, it can answer all those questions in a variety of concatenations. So it saves, you know, that another 4 to 6 hours of somebody on my team to go, did I have to go task to go do that? Now they could just feed it into a AI and it spits it out. So there are all practical uses for it, right?
No, 15 minutes of QC after saving 4 hours is certainly a great deal. Like, because I tell everyone, make sure you check it, but chances are it'll be good, but you're going to catch a few things. But do the QC and save yourself 4 hours, and then give the process back 15 minutes, and you'll be golden.
And where I was going with that is, that's where I see the market going initially, is towards those kind of cost savings and time savings. You know, do I think it's going to do away with an admin? No, I don't. Not for another 10 years. Why? Because my admin knows who I am. My admin knows my habits. My admin knows my schedule and knows where to deconflict. And AI could probably learn some of that, but I don't have the time to go deconflict that if I have, you know, customer meetings, et cetera, contract negotiations, whatever the case would be, right? So I don't see some of that going away, which I think is a misnomer, like you were talking about. We went way tangential here.
You started
I did start it.
it.
So what I want to get back to, because we were talking about financial and how AI plays into financial, I want to get back to that. So I'm going to hand it to you, Dexter, to get us back on track. Because I think I you know that I know that you know that I know where you're going.
So I think the downstream effects of AI, as we are at right now, that we need to think about it at a broader macro level is, so everything you just talked about, maybe it's not going to eliminate your job position, or it's not going to eliminate an admin's job position, but it might change some of the workloads to the point where inside a department you need one less guy, two less guys, five less guys. And the attrition that could be coming, you know, the deployment of AI will make individual managers much, much more productive. You know, process engineer types like agentic AI is really going to make them much more productive, to the point that it's going to lead to excess supply in these specialized people. That's going to suppress the market value of those types of positions. And that downward wage pressure, I think, is going to move a lot of people from making 240K to 160K pretty quickly, which is not usually where we think of the most effects in a economic disruption. But if you think about that band of pretty highly compensated people, that's a serious effect on mortgage origination, right? And so especially if rates, you know, and Tom can chime in here, if Fed rates only go down about a point and a half in the next 24 months as this job destruction and salary reduction comes online, which I think is probably what I would I mean, listen, we're not even talking about the potential for war right now. I'm just saying, like, I don't see more than a point and a half going down. Like, how are these mortgages and like two income families? Like, it's going to be a real huge effect on any recovery in real estate, because you can buy a much better house with 2x240 than you can with 2x160, assuming that equally compensated people. And which is not even the best assumption at the mean, you know?
Yeah,
So.
and it's a 30%, a 25 to 30%, loss in income versus a 5% loss or in mortgage payment, right? Based on rates, like it's an asymmetric trade at that point. So yeah, no, and I agree with you. I don't see the Fed. I mean, well, depends on what Trump does in February next year or whatever, April of next year, but. Yeah, no, point and a half is would be a lot in this environment, depending. Well, again, depends on a lot of other things occurring that are exogenous, two, three sigma events, or even five sigma events. Let's not even talk about the six or 10 sigma events, because then we're not talking about
Well,
anything.
and
And
I was
other
just
than
pointing out, I just picked 1.5 out of the air to say,
right, no, but I think it's a
if
fair, I think
that's
it's a
if you lose that much income and rates only go down that much, you're still priced out of the market. It's just.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not enough to even. I mean, a point and a half is enough to refi your current house, but it's not enough to offset the loss of wages, right? And your current house. So, well, I mean, but this gets into a couple other things about, then what do we see on the horizon for what the Trump administration may or may not be doing in order to try and offset some of these things, and or try and keep people in their homes. And then we get into, then you get into conjecture about where they're going to go to, quote unquote, monetize the balance sheet of the country. And then, and that's some, this is stuff that I've talked about previously. And we've written for the new written about for the newsletter, and I've heard rumbles of up on Capitol Hill. And I think those things are there. I think those countervailing ideas are there because I think there's a lot of people. I mean, remember who got Trump elected? He's got three factions behind him. He's got patriots within the DOD and the intelligence services. He's got Wall Street and he's got the little tech. He's got he's got the PayPal mafia, the tech bros. If that confluence of people should understand all of the things we just talked about, and they're going to need to be able to craft some way of alleviating that deflationary pressure on wages in order to keep the housing market and the banking system from imploding. Right. And I think that's part of, that's a vulnerability, right? The wage deflation we just discussed is all a big vulnerability. And of course, if we know that and they know that, then our opponents know that. Hence why we're dealing with this, crazy bullshit of whatever Alex Padilla thought he was going to pull today during Kristi Noem's press conference, and what's happening in LA and what's going to happen over the weekend and everything else. So, there's all of these things are happening right at this moment in time. And this is where Steve is feeling the acute worry about, things accelerating from here throughout the summer. And I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm hoping that, ultimately this has been somewhat planned for. Not that you can plan for everything, but that there's no plan survives contact with the enemy. But at the very least, that these have been wargamed out at some level by everybody on both sides. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm cautiously optimistic with the way they've handled LA so far. It looks like it's been as bad as it has been. It could have been and should have been a lot worse. And I think they were expecting a different response from Trump and company than they got. I saw, him nationalizing the California Guard and moving in the Marines immediately is a successful template for killing a color revolution in its crib. That's the way Putin and his and company have done that in the past in places like Kazakhstan and Belarus and other places. So I'm watching that play itself out. So
without drilling down on this, because right, everybody's talking about it, right? Mm-hmm. I think we'll see what actions happen on contact as this No King Day unfolds tomorrow. But I think you're right. I think that the fact he federalized the Garden Reserve and mobilized the Garden Reserve around California precluded stand down orders, lag time, and because when you deploy those assets, especially Garden Reserve, they have to get notification, then they have to mobilize, then they have to deploy. And they bypassed mm-hmm. all that, just sent a warning order and said go. And that if he does that across the country, I think we won't see the kinetic that I'm expecting, but we will see some kinetic, but it'll be very limited. So, and I think that will be a tell for, let's just say, the follow-on actions. But here's the unknown factor in this that I think most people are discounting, and that is how many of the extreme right are going to show up to counter this, because that's when things go off the rails. And right now,
and then how much of the fake extreme right are going to come?
I was just kidding there. So
see, yeah, that's the thing, is I think between Charlottesville and January 6th, though, the number of people who are going to follow that Pied Piper who are actually on the right is minimal. And after the sort of curb stomping that these people are getting in California, I mean, the most important thing that's happened in the last couple of days that shows me that somebody's finally learned a lesson is they didn't spend all their time, meaning the administration and everybody, did not spend all their time talking about the riots, qua the riots. They spent a lot of time literally calling out these left-wing organizational structures, No Kings and Indivisible. These are basically Media Matters style, Emily's List style, like Democratic, conglomerations of like, we're going to protest Trump and we're going to do this for 4 years. And they just called them out, and it's all over social media. And it's also been like literally called out from the podium. I think that's a huge difference. Consider that January 6th, Trump wanted to get the National Guard on scene, Pelosi blocked him, and that was something that we didn't really hear about for 3-4 months. How different would it have been if he had gotten up and pounded the podium and said they're blocking before the event had even happened, right? I think there's an awareness of this, I mean, to call it what it is, a conspiracy to create a narrative. This is all about narrative construction. The entire No Kings thing is a very simple process that Newsom's been part of, right? The narrative is Donald Trump is a fascist. So in order to make visual confirmation of that, we need to have riots that forces a military response. And then we'll just say fascist, 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 you know, till the sun goes down.
Well, the standard playbook, right? That's the standard color revolution playbook. And
is both a color revolution attempt, but also weirdly an attempt to run a re-election campaign against Trump, even though he's not going to run again. Like when Newsom stood up and I'm like, dude, you're using all your political capital to be the foil to Trump, who's not going to run for president again. Like, do you not even know how this works? They're literally playing to their base's desire to relitigate the election they just lost, which is a real dumb thing for any American political party to waste their time with. I mean, they still don't know who's in charge of the party, and that's pretty obvious.
Well,
it's not David Hogg.
No. Well, there's
yesterday.
I think the party's splintering as we speak, right? So I think that process is going to continue. But one thing that I think is playing against this narrative that Trump is leveraging, because Trump's really good at, he's really good at beating the drum for what the average American thinks, right? He's like Putin, right? He can get in the trenches and talk about the affliction of what's happening and the embarrassment and the humiliation of the working class by the elite Hamama, right? That standard communist doctrine. He's good at that. And one of the things that I've seen, and that, Tom, this goes back to our conversation last November, right? Mm-hmm. When you do influencing operations, you do them for a very long time, because it takes a long time for people to adopt the idea, and you have to reinforce it, and you have to change the BS every, you know, couple of months to make sure people are still getting something fresh. And one thing that's changed since November is most people they're tired of the LGBTQ+ whatever narrative, right? Right. They're tired of the narrative, right? They have fatigue from that. But because of the way things transpired, you're seeing more and more people that have a large distrust for anything that comes out of both the federal government as well as the political system. So they already don't buy the narrative to begin with, and they're already skeptical. And then when they start to go and do research, people have figured out, I'll just wait 48 hours. We'll see what really comes out of this. And Tom, I think you said it on another show. This initial thing that started in LA, they were rolling up the financiers for a major money laundering operation that was linked to the cartels and linked to child trafficking. And so they're going after the funding sources, which is why they're all screaming so loud. But the problem is there's more and more of the public that's awake to what has been going on because of the USA Doge disclosures, right? Get away from what they haven't institutionalized or done any of the institutionalization of the Doge cuts. What Doge really did from an information perspective is they highlighted how incestuous all these relationships are between all these organizations and how embedded the organizations were into the federal government financial system and how they were all using taxpayer dollars to fund all of their illicit activities. And so now the public's wide awake to it. So now when they see things, where I'm going with this is, let's say this No King Day, which, by the way, Dex, you're right, they messaged this perfectly, perfect psychological operation to get people to all the Orange Man Bad crowd to line up and go protest in the streets. But they've set conditions to conduct a false flag. By Trump federalizing all the federal forces and moving them in there, he's taken away their ability to restrict that and conduct those attacks in a lot of major cities. So now their options are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And as they're going after the financiers, they're taking away all of their pieces on the board to be able to conduct operations the way they used to, right? Because they operated with impunity under USAID. Mm-hmm. So the one thing that hasn't been dismantled yet, which I'm waiting to see if it's dismantled, is all the overseas NGOs. They're all still in place. None of them have been definanced or defunded. They're all still a place waiting to resume operations of moving people in. And China is still building a bridge down in Panama in the Darien Gap to move people here. So I'm waiting to see how he handles that. But
I've seen that the EU has, like, not that the EU has any money, but they'll print it, that the EU is willing to, has already stated, you know, unequivocally that they're going to take that NGO structure over. If the United States isn't going to fund it anymore, then they will continue to do so. So we know exactly where, you know, this, that now they're like, oh, well, now we have to pay for it. This is an interesting point that, you know, I know you watched the thing I just did with Tommy Kerrigan and Ian Burlingame, and we went over the three in our talk. We went over the three stages of the finance of the money. Like, how do you get rid of their money?
Financial kill chain.
You start with the public money, which is the easiest stuff. It's the stuff you directly control. You say, nope, no more USAID, no more NED, no more endowments to Harvard, blah, 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 blah. Now you got to start going after the private money. And that's what these LA riots are about. So they went after, say, started going after the private money that's floating around the world, the cartel money and all the rest of it. After that, and this is where the financial markets come in. This is why I keep screaming at Trump's, leave Powell alone. He's doing great. Which is you have to get them to, once you've dried up the public and private money, which is, you know, from illicit operations, then you got to get them to put their seed corn on the table. You got to get them to take their trillions of dollars or however much money they've got in the banks that nobody knows the names of, and start putting that money on the freaking table. That's, or they've got to start getting their governments that they still control to start printing trillions of dollars in order to fund the stuff. But that's going to destroy their investment profile from the market perspective. We're going to look at it and go, well, I don't want to buy German bonds at 2.5% if you guys are going to, you know, blow $200 billion on hookers and blow in order to destabilize the United States. It's not going to work. And this is the process that can't, like, happen overnight. And unfortunately, it's a thing that, you know, my friend Alexander Mercurius likes to say, political time is slower, illegal time is slower than political time, you know, and financial time is the stuff we're really used to moving quickly. Well, these things, in effect, especially in the from a financial perspective, once the political time and the legal time catches up to the markets, then that's when the markets go from, oh, everything's fine, to no, they're not. And everything starts to change. So what we've seen so far for this year has been a 6-month psychological operation that the United States is going to fall apart under the demon Trump, because their Trump Fuhrer doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. That is rapidly coming to a close this week. And I think financial markets across the entire space this week have been very pretty clear. This is kind of a transitional week in that respect. So let's see how the second half of 2026 plays itself out. Trying to bring this back in line to what should people prepare for.
No, right. I know where you're going. That's why I let you go.
There's also one little insert I'd like to point out about this DC No Kings thing. So when we contrast that with Jan 6th, when Bill Barr was so Garland was sworn in March of 21, and obviously most prosecutions of people who were at Jan 6th happened under his watch. But Barr was also, I think he all had already stepped down and, like, someone else was running. It was like very, he was very non-participatory and certainly not protecting Trump in any way. And not to say that Trump needed protection is not my view of Jan 6, because I think Jan 6 was largely a created stunt, like what we're about to see. Well, we have a much different situation, don't we? We have Pam Bondi ready to expose the identities of all these, you know, false actors who are pretending to be something they're not. And they're going to get cuffed and stuffed. They're also going to get their masks ripped off. And if the Democrats think they can run this level of operation at this scale, they're delusional, because not only is it going to blow up in their face, but, you know, this administration is charging members of Congress with felonies for felonies that were apparently or at least allegedly committed. And that is a huge change, a sea change in the big picture. And it should not be, you know, definitely you should consider that in the midst of all this, because for whatever Europe thinks they can do, they can't do it here.
Right.
Yep. Very good point. But the one piece that we're leaving out that people aren't paying attention to is, remember, we still have a lot of military age males that are still in this country that haven't been pushed out or moved out. either voluntarily or involuntarily. And so we can't discount them either. But I think you're right. I think this is their last gasp, and it's going to blow up in their face because the narrative's already blowing up. So anyway, with that said, what to prepare for?
Well, two things that just, I don't know if you guys have seen it in the last hour or so, but first, the IRS commissioner's been confirmed. And the second, that the President Trump and DHS Secretary Kristi Noem have just mobilized the IRS to Los Angeles to track down who's funding the riots.
Beautiful.
Wow. Nice.
I mean, this is literally,
that's not going to end in any illegals. Ago. That's not going to end in somebody's like, you know, and that's not going to be an illegals like crypto wallet or their, it's going to somebody else's. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's, well, it's, I don't even think it'll be necessarily California. I think it'll be, right. You know,
Katie Hobbs better watch herself.
That's beautiful stuff.
No, I just got to throw it out there. So, but what should people prepare for? Like at this moment in time, like this is, I mean, we've been saying it for years, but let's not kid ourselves. Like it's here now. Like you've got to get your cash flow positive in every way, manner, shape, and form. You've got to get yourself in a position where you can ride out a 3 to 4 month disruption of services. I mean, I've been, you know, it's going to be that kind of scenario again. And I wouldn't go, you know, I wouldn't get to, I don't know about, but we're going to have attacks on our supply chains. And, you know, we're going to have people panicking when this stuff starts to brown out. Like you and I talked about this at the beginnings of COVID, Dexter. Like this was stuff that he and I were talking about, like in January of 2020. Like it was like, dude, start buying alcohol and paper towels now, because I can see it coming. And this is something you and I talked about the other day as well. So, but it is really important to understand that, you know, if you've got, you know, this is not a time to be fully invested in the markets. For example, this is not a time to have, you know, your, you know, this is the time to be raising some amount of cash, being defensive and, you know, watching this all with a very weather eye, because, you know, the way I prep this for the subscribers in Gold, Ghosts, and Guns all the time is to say, look, you know, it's very clear that what we're seeing in the markets itself is yet another psychological operation. The markets themselves are one big psychological operation because the central banks have so much power with which to move markets, along with and a lot of the markets themselves are very much tied to liquidity, and they don't have a lot of places that they a lot of these large markets, they don't have a lot of different places that they could sink money into. And this is why you see capital like fleeing from stem to stern, going from the DAX to the Dow to the treasury market. This is why you see all of this stuff on a regular basis. And it's why we're starting to accept a higher degree of volatility than we have in the past. And if you're not comfortable with that volatility now, just wait. Like, so we're going to just see, we're in the churn, I think is the best way to put it. If you've ever seen The Expanse, you know, Amos's description of the churn, I think, is incredibly important. I think we're seeing the churn in financial markets. We're seeing the churn happen now at the societal level. And, you know, don't be dumb and think that it's all you're going to wake up tomorrow and everything's going to work properly. We're doing this on Zoom today because StreamYard wasn't working properly, for example.
Mm-hmm. So, to your point, the attack on the logistics infrastructure has already begun. It started 2 months ago, and it's been, you know, attacks on retail logistics. Yeah, well, they're more targeted right now. I know because I'm responding to Tilton's extra. I was responding to them. I've responded to more cyber attacks in the last 3 months than I have in my entire career. Just the pace and the number are coming fast and furious. And this, I wouldn't be surprised today to hear that the fiber lines that were cut at Google are probably, somebody did it on purpose. I'm not going to say attack, but I'll just say it's out there. So stay out of the markets is one thing I hear. What for the average Joe that's not in the markets, what other things besides having cash on hands? Because I've said have food, water for a couple of weeks, have, you know, of course have ammo and weapons, but what else can the average Joe do?
I think the longer timeline is, you know, both in regards to AI, which we talked about earlier, but, you know, start really building a cash cushion so that you can pay your obligations if we're still living in a world where you feel like you should, you know, for 4 or 5 months at a time. Like it's, you know, everybody's situation is different. Obviously, if you can pay off your debt and cinch your belt and start putting cash on the sideline, do it. If you can't pay off your debt, figure out the best way that you can start putting future payments aside. You know, however you can make these numbers work is, you know, you got to be analytical about your own finances, but also, I mean, understand that with AI, like prepare for income disruption. And the best way to do that is figure out how to monetize AI to your benefit, you know, in any way possible. Learn something about it. All the models are pretty close. You do not need to subscribe to all of them. Learn one at the free level and then subscribe for a couple of months and really learn what AI is and what it isn't. And as it comes to pass, like, you know, that may help insulate you from job disruption. You know, there's a lot, it's like we said earlier in the podcast, like there's a lot to it and there's going to be a lot of cycles, but that doesn't mean that people aren't going to get fired for dumb reasons. So the more you can make yourself look like an AI knowledge worker, the better. Unfortunately, I think the tech bros want to, you know, their vision of the future is very, you know, I think an avoidable dystopia where all the third world, you know, the work units are all done in the third world by Filipinos and India, mechanical Turk style. But, you know, there's no reason why Americans can't get their foot into this rapid change in the data economy. And, you know, we're not going to get Jetson styles flying cars. We're going to get something else, but we all need to be part of it. So don't sit on the sidelines and watch this all happen. Get in right. The game of AI if you have any technology in your resume, and even if you don't, frankly, because AI is going to empower people to do things that used to be out of the range of their imagination because coding or hiring a developer was beyond their reach. I got news for you. If you're a logical thinker and you can sit down and learn how to write a software requirements document, you can Google this. You can ask your AI. That's one thing AI will give you really good answers. Like, and then sit down and think about some data process. I got news for you. You could be an entrepreneur tomorrow for far less money than you could ever have done even 2-3 years ago, because you're not going to have to hire a developer for $100,000 a year. Chances are you'll be able to, you know, build an interesting idea. Now the competition, like the cost is dropping for everyone, but there's a lot of possibility as much as there's a lot of things to worry about. It's kind of my... Dystopia is not inevitable.
No, I agreed. And the other thing is, and I've been, you know, it's funny. I have, you know, I've talked about this before. I have a 19-year-old daughter, and, you know, I've had that discussion with her as well. And even though she's like unbelievably hostile to AI. But the other thing she and I've talked about, we've stressed is like the demand destruction is going to be in the white collar jobs, as we've identified. What this means is, we have a dearth of people who are capable of doing blue collar jobs, and the blue collar jobs are all being deported if Trump gets his way and the Democrats don't get, and the commies don't get their way. It means there's going to be a demand for just strong backs to go out and do work and rebuild the world that has been, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Abandoned, right?
Also, and just to keep up with the depreciation curve of reality, like stuff wears out.
Right. Shit wears out. We have worked, you know, this, and that's what I mean is like we've neglected our basic life. We've been neglected our basic, the basic infrastructure. And you can see what Trump is clearly trying to do, which is to court money coming in to rebuild the country and to rebuild that from the ground up and provide those real opportunities. So, you know, investing is about hitting where, you know, and making money is the whole Willie Killer thing. Hit them where they ain't. There ain't no people like Mike Rowe's been banging his shoe on the table, not like Khrushchev, for years, saying we need pipe fitters, we need friggin' electrical, you know, line runners. Like we're gonna have this AI revolution. I got news for you. That means we gotta lay a lot of goddamned copper. And there's a lot of young men in this country who don't have to bemoan their fate that they can't get a job as an influencer on YouTube playing fucking video games. I mean, I know that's, I'm being a little bit of a dick about this, but seriously, like, go out and like get a real freaking job.
Well, you're bringing to light the part of the cultural shift that has to happen with this, right?
And I think it's coming.
It's already happening, right? But the cultural shift is, in the 80s and 90s, the academic elites in DC and in the university system convinced everybody that going from high school into a trade was a dead end road, and that you really had to go to college to be successful. And I think we're moving out of that now, and the trades are becoming more and more important. And I think we're going to see more of that, because you're right. Somebody's got to build the stuff, because AI can't build the stuff. It can do the plan. It can order all the materials, but it can't put it together, even with a 3D printer. So there's going to be demand for the trades for the foreseeable future.
And local production is coming. I mean, between 3D printing and AI help, AI assisted design, and everything else, like, we have a dearth of tool and die shops in this country. Like,
we do.
You know, we have the ability for the local communities to be able to like repair the local combine and the local and the local hay baler.
Welders.
We need guys.
Like, basic mechanical engineers, not like extreme like engine designers, but people who can make armatures and like just stuff to move stuff and like stuff to make rollers work, you know, just basic mech-y stuff, like, but that is hugely important to run a process environment. And the one thing I'll say is, keep in mind that if you are out there and you're a blue collar guy who's pretty smart, and there's a ton of roll-ups happening in this country that scares me very much, like whether it's your dentist, your vet, your your air conditioning installer, your plumber, your electrician. Private equity is going through and buying. No, it's not visible because they never change the name, right? And mm-hmm. if you can figure out, if you're that guy and you haven't gone through this, and you can figure out even how to leverage AI and build that tool and die shop and don't sell out to these pricks, you're going to be in the catbird seat, man. You will mm-hmm. have a hugely valuable business. If you sell out to these private equity guys, they will screw you, they will load debt on you, and they will turn you into not even an employee. Like, for instance, if you work for like an air conditioning company, that's like a 20-year-old air conditioning company, they're like a good local company with 100 employees. That's a great place to work, probably, right? They get bought by PE, all of a sudden, it's a crappy place to work and everything's cut. And then they tell you to lie to your customers and tell them, oh, you need a new air conditioner, when the air conditioner is 7 years old. And you know, you're gonna feel the taint of these people on you when you go to work every day. So if you can look at the world that we're in right now and carve out your little spot and be really aware of what's going on within the trades, this roll-up phenomenon. I mean, this is a whole nother podcast. So yeah, I'm just throwing it in here, and we can talk about it in the future, and maybe Tom and I will talk about it, or
By the way, I could have lived my whole life without that visual Dexter. So thank you for that. Because you're saying I'm visualizing.
I meant the stench. Like, never mind. I just really love private equity guys. It's just me.
I can tell.
So just to finish that point on private equity, they're doing that because they're feeling the pinch that they don't have any other places to go friggin' rape and plunder anymore. That's why they're going where they're going.
Well, and they don't have the free capital, right? And
because so they don't
now
have the
they're trying to rearrange their balance sheets to, I mean, they're screwing everybody to pay off they all got caught with their hands in the cookie jar too. And the sooner they all get their hands chopped off, the better, but it hasn't happened yet. And, you know, they're putting a lot of great companies out of business that had good businesses just because they saddled them with bullshit debt that had nothing to do with operations.
The most recent example is Joanne Faber, for example. But this is one of those things that I remember, you know, when Powell started raising rates, I remember chatting with Daniel DiMartino Booth about this very thing. And I said, well, they don't call him private equity Powell for nothing. And he said, yeah, and they can't get him on the phone right now. And they're screaming. This was 4 years ago. They are screaming that he can't raise rates. They're all fucked. So again, we've always lived under this rubric that the big banks run everything and the central banks run everything, and that it's the plutocrats run the world, and they're just going to suck us all dry like fucking vampires. But we don't have that administration anymore. For lack, for he's not going to, I don't think in any way that Donald Trump is perfect, but he understands the fundamental problem. And I think the people around him understand the fundamental problem. And I also think that at a certain level, we're getting in a long run, like it's clear what they want to do, which is to segregate and the banking industry back into the, let the big G-SIBs do the big projects like they're supposed to and handle the international finance and international liquidity, and then leave the local and regional banks to do their thing. And there's only one way to do that. And that is to change the dynamic of the cash flow so that we're not sending dollars out to buy rapidly depreciating consumer goods and then be left with the fucking interest on the debt. That has to change. We have to want to invest in our own country and invest in whatever treasuries, you know, we still issue after we've, you know, fixed the fiscal position. And that's where, and then, you know, we'll use our local banks and our regional banks as the means by which to rebuild Main Street and repurpose Wall Street in a fundamentally different way. But like when the globalists were running the fucking world, like Wall Street was empowered to do this shit. Like, and then, you know, you could even make the argument that they didn't have any other options either.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's not, you know, I'm not calling them victims here or anything, but understand that, you know, they got into this and then it was going to get turned on them and they were going to get wiped out. And that's why they're in the position now where they're backing this play that Trump is making. And it's you know, oh, by the way, the rescission bill passed the House, the $9.4 billion in DOGE cuts have been codified, but passed through the House. Guess who voted against it?
Massey and Rand.
Yeah.
Well, in the House, so Massey.
Yeah, yeah. Rand will come. I mean, let's not veer into like how much
politics.
No. I love libertarians. One thing, just quick acronym. A G-SIB is a global systemically important bank. Yes. Another way of saying too big to fail. I mean, I hope we are in the first act of the returning of the pricing of risk in general, mm-hmm. because everything that we've talked about in the last 15, 20 minutes is some version of risk has been mispriced for a very long time. And if we're moving towards a world where risk is properly priced, all these private equity guys are going to die. And I mean, maybe literally, hopefully, they're just too levered. Like the free money, even with rates, you know, obviously are not what they were, but they, you know, a lot of the lines they took out, you know, were not necessarily adjustable in the way we think about it. They've been able to survive on the businesses they bought with that money. And if risk is truly priced, we're going to lead towards smaller bank creation. We're going to go away from too big to fail. All of that is on the board, right? And mm-hmm. And yet, the world where money has been this cheap this long is a world that has empowered a class of just greedy, indolent fools, and they are not going to give this up easily. So this is the fight we're in. Make no mistake, where the root cause of almost everything we're seeing is that we have a class of parasite morons who run the world as we know it, and they've scaled up institutions that have no right to exist based on the fact that they've just polluted the very concept of valuation of labor, of goods, of capital markets, of everything. And mm-hmm. to undo it is going to be a very cataclysmic event. We've only just started.
Boy, I couldn't have said that better myself. And I would add, so I only have one rule. So when we do shows in the future, you have to remember this rule. You cannot be more bitter and angry than I am. That's the only rule I have. You can hit the guardrails. You can slide along the guardrails, but you can't climb over those guardrails just for the future. But that said, I would add to it that this system was created by a group of sociopaths that were attracted to it because it was so easy. There was no barriers to entry for a lot of them. And the system incentivized them to be more greedy. And you're right. I think it's going to take us decades to unwind this, but we have to unwind it culturally too, right? Because the other problem we have is we have a group of parasites in the political system that frankly are psychopaths, and all of them have to go away.
Well, we have to unite the right and the left that there's a ton of people on both sides who are programmatically like oppositional to one another for the dumbest reasons that are inorganic. You know, they're just not real. And I think the more, you know, the first month of Occupy Wall Street was something a lot of people don't remember before it was completely, you know, co-opted by many outside forces. But like the honest, just frustration and not rage, because that's what, you know, rage is not the answer. The answer is steadfast anger, nonviolent, steadfast anger. And that is something that I think, you know, could come. Like, I mean, there's the more people understand the mechanics of what we're all kind of living under, the more I think the farcical two-party system doesn't have long. I mean, Trump's not a Republican. Can we talk about that? And the level of histrionics about people who think they hate Trump. It's like, you know, he's a mid, I mean, he's a Democrat at heart on most of the stuff he's selling people now. You know, it's just,
but he's a moderate.
But they like him because he is what he is. He's not part of that system, and he's real enough for them. And a lot of people voted for him who have never voted for Republican before. And where that goes, I mean, whether Elon and him are making up, like, I don't really believe in third parties in America for a variety of reasons, but I'm always hopeful, you know, you know, we'll see.
Well, we'll wrap it up. We'll wrap it on that, but just final comment on that. I think there's a whole show to be done just on Smith-Mund Modernization Act and how that's led to
absolutely
the polarization of our society, and how the propaganda war has affected not just the cultural narrative and the social narrative, but people's psyche and how much they've been immersed in propaganda over the last 20 years.
Yep.
I think that's affected, because I remember, I'm going to date myself, I remember Teddy Kennedy talking about his Republicans, that he would go and have dinner and cigars with his Republican friends across the aisle just so they could talk. Not mm-hmm. about the politics, not about the bills, but just talk and find common ground as individuals. We've lost that because it's been programmatically pushed out of our system by all the propaganda that's been forced on the American public. I mean, it's everywhere now. I think we do a whole show on that. I know I could, because
yep.
it was my business for so long. But yeah, that said, I would love to do another show with the two of you. And I think I'll focus it better next time for you, Tom, so we can stay on topic and not go tangential. But no, great discussion. And I really appreciate both jumping on, because this is, and I know this is hard to schedule, so I appreciate that too. We'll do this again. God bless everyone. One team, one fight.